We're sort of novices at recording. So the theme, as you will have noticed from the flyer, is the idea of bringing compassion to our wisdom, which is a way of talking about the two major sides of the practice, the part that we approach conceptually with the mind, trying to understand the teachings, and on the other side, establishing a kind of balance is the qualities of open-heartedness with which we want to greet life. We want to be open to all that life brings us, not just in the sense of intellectually teasing and understanding out of it, but allowing it to really flow through our being. So at one level, this is what the Buddha came to describe as finding a middle path. That's a metaphor that applies to a number of aspects in the practice where there are extremes of one type or another. In the original formulation of it, the Buddha's life experience coming to awakening and attaining Buddhahood involved being raised initially as a prince and being very indulged physically with all of the pleasurable things of life. And in fact, the story goes that when he was born, his father was told of a prophecy that his son, the newly born son, would either be a great leader in a political sense or in a spiritual sense. And the father, being a king of an area of India, decided the way to go would be the political one. So he wanted to hide his son from anything that might stimulate him in a spiritual direction. And not only hide him from religious or spiritual teachings, but hide him from any aspects of life which might lead him to ask questions about the difficulties of life, which might steer him in a spiritual direction. So he created these settings, these pleasure palace settings, where the young Siddhartha wasn't exposed to any of the harsh realities of life. And the story goes that at some point he became so frustrated with this, he talked his charioteer into sneaking him out and taking him into the town where he was able to see what life is like for regular people. And there he saw what are described as the three messengers. He came across people who were aging, ill, and dying, all of which were they don't sound like revelations to us, but to him they were startling revelations and made him question everything he'd been raised around. And then the last influential thing he was exposed to was he came across some ascetic spiritual practitioners. And he came to become very concerned with the suffering in the world and decided that this overindulgent life that he's led was not a way to explore this at all, and decided to pursue the life of the ascetic, or the ascetic, not the aesthetic. Anyway, he committed himself to an extensive period of extreme asceticisms. So in his life, he experimented with both the extremes of sensual indulgence and then sensual aversion and denial, and came at the point of almost being at the point of death from the commitment to the ascetic explorations he was doing. He came upon this idea of a middle path, which is recognizing that the body has legitimate needs. It needs wholesome food if it's going to be healthy enough to be mentally alert and physically stable in order to pursue spiritual investigations. And you need to have some clothes on your body or else you're going to get sick and have that be a distraction from that. So over time, he came to this understanding of a middle path, which, as I say, initially had that implication of being a middle ground between sensual indulgence and self-denial. But for our practice, it has That idea of a middle path has broader implications still than that. It speaks to, among other things, the issue of the qualities of effort we put into the practice. Are we, there's an extreme of being too comfortable or too low an energy state to be energetic enough to really investigate and see what's going on. And at the other extreme, there's the possibility of being over aroused, overstimulated, agitated. And the Buddha's teachings and the path he promoted were geared toward centering along that energetic dimension as well. I just finished this committed practice class where we were talking about right speech, which is part of the virtue elements of his teachings. And he typically, or the teachings typically begin with an emphasis on attaining virtue because it quiets the mind if we live a virtuous life. If we're going around doing unwholesome things to other people, or overindulging ourselves for that matter, if we're lying and stealing and just doing unwholesome things, our life gets into a state of agitation. If we're lying, we wind up investing energy in protecting the lies we've put out and making sure that no one figures out the truth. And we wind up telling lies on top of lies. And then we wind up thinking, well, did I cover my trail properly? And the same thing with thievery or any other wholesome activity. So living a life of virtue is a framework for establishing a life of calm, which allows us to pursue other things and have energy that might get dragged into those kinds of unwholesome activities. That energy is now available for pursuing wholesome things. So that second continuum would be energy. And the third is the issue of working with the mind as a conceptual tool, where we're trying to sort of slice our way into wisdom by having an incisive mind that penetrates and grasps and analyzes on the one hand. And there are elements of that. There are certainly teachings in this practice that benefit from thought and reflection. And on the other side, there's this whole open-hearted quality side. And the reality is that we benefit when those two factors are in balance. Each of those has its areas of risk and danger, and there are practices within those categories. So in the type of work we do conceptually, there's a variety of skills we can use to work with those wholesomely. And on the heartfelt side, there's things to be aware of and be careful about. And then, so we achieve balance within each area, but then there's this gross balancing that's achieved between the two. And we want to touch on some of that in both those realms with you over this weekend. So let me say, let me look at my notes for a second here. What I want to do is go a little deeper into both the head and the heart sides of the equation. But before I do that, I just want to say some general things about what we mean when we talk about balance. When you think about balancing between opposites, the first thing that comes to mind, which is probably operating at the sort of a mundane level of awareness, is the thought of compromise. So if there's overindulgence on one side and self-denial on the other, the middle is some formula of balanced life that's neither too indulgent nor too self-denying. There's a lot to be said for that. But there's a danger in it as well, in that it's constructed out of a sense of absolutes. We have a sense of what the extreme is on one end. We have a sense of what the extreme is on the other. And we construct the middle ground. And we can then become very attached and rigid about that. So when we arrive at something which is through a sort of conceptual mundane compromise, we then have we are at risk of getting rigid about operating in this narrow middle zone. So one sense of the middle ground is that finding a compromise, and it has some values, but it has a downside too. We can become rigid in the definition, and we can become identified and feel like I'm a balanced person, and we can get problematic around that. In the same way that we can say I am this person that has all the sweet things in life, or I am this person that's invested in denying myself of things, I can say I'm this person who's careful about living the balanced, centered life. So there's another possible category of definition of what we mean by middle ground, though, which I think is richer for us. And that is the idea of, instead of a mundane definition, it's what the Buddha would call supermundane or transcendent. And that is that rather than attaching to a central idea, attaching to a middle ground, what we can do is become very spacious and allow everything to play out within that space and simply avoid attachment to any of it. So I can allow myself moments of indulgence. I may want an ice cream, and now and then I might have an ice cream, you know, or I may, there'll be other times when I feel like I just want to live a very Spartan existence for a time, and I could go that way too. But I can do that in such a way that I don't get attached and identified with any of it. So I create a space for myself, and I allow all of my humanity some play within that space. And in that is a quality of compassion that acknowledges that within my being there are countless disparate elements, all of which are at one time or another essential to who I am. They're just there. And it's okay to allow those to express themselves. The danger is in getting attached and building a sense of identification and a sense of self. And once I do that, I say, well, this is who I am, so I reject allowing myself to be any of those other things. So instead, we can simply live a life in which we allow spontaneity and variety to express itself without getting attached to any of it at all, or at least minimizing that attachment. So that's a broader sense of what we mean by a middle path. It's a middle path of acceptance, and it accepts variety as well as an arbitrary idea of what the center has to look like. So there's a couple other things to be aware of there. One is that each of us is different. Now, when I say different, I think there is that vast aspect of countless elements of humanity, and you know, it's probably true that we all have some of all of it, but the overall patterns can be different. Some of us are going to have more of something than another. We may be more intuitively intellectual than other people. We might be more intuitively operating from the open heart than others. But all of those factors have some play within us. But we are different. So our middle paths are different. So that creates, there's a few things that I think are interesting that we can say about that. One is that the role of a teacher is very interesting, given that, because neither Bridget nor I, nor do I think anyone else, can tell you what your middle path should look like. We can tell you, we can give you some guidance, we can give you some suggestions about how to investigate and how to sense when you're going too far in one direction or another. But basically, what your middle path looks like is for you to figure out for yourself. Another aspect of the differences between us is that it is a challenge to those of us that have comparing minds. Some of us think that other people have a better middle path than we do. You know, this person has their act more together than I. I have more my act more together than that person. If we understand that we're all truly individual, then we slowly grow in the wisdom that allows us to relax that comparing mind, because that better than, worse than, same as, all of that is a source of suffering in our lives. It's a source of dis-ease and stress. So that's something to become aware of and really appreciate the differences between ourselves. Another aspect of the idea of difference is that not only are there significant differences between individuals, but each of us is ourselves changing over time. So we're different tomorrow. We will be different tomorrow than we are today. The factors at play that are popping up inside the space of our existence are going to be a little different later than they are now. And that means that our middle path is going to be a little different later than it is now. So part of what we're doing here is not finding a single middle path that suits us now and will suit us till the day we die, but hopefully we're developing a way to sense when we are in balance, when we are comfortable with ourselves, when the factors of energy and relaxation are in balance, when the factors of intellect and open-heartedness are in balance, and recognizing that all of that is dynamic, and it's changing within us, and it's changing in response to the conditions around us. So what we're doing is learning how to monitor. We're learning how to see clearly and how to evaluate what it is we're seeing in a constantly changing context. And hopefully we're learning how to do that with compassion, because especially at the beginning of that learning process, we're not going to be terrific at it. And we're going to be getting better and better at it as we go, but only if we keep our spirits up and are compassionate with ourselves, especially at the difficult learning curve part where we begin. So we've got a couple more minutes before we're going to do a first sitting. So I want to say just a few more things about the kind of energy that we can bring to this process. In a complementary teaching of the Buddha, there's this teaching of the seven factors of awakening. And those factors can be understood in terms of their energetics. There's a set of factors which are arousing and stimulating. There's a set of factors which are calming and centering. And there's three in each group, and then the seventh factor is the factor of mindfulness. So in mindfulness, mindfulness is there as sort of an overriding quality of awareness that is present and evaluating what's going on over time. So in addition to the idea of presence and non-judgmental presence, which we often emphasize when we talk about mindfulness, there's also a memory or awareness over time component. And that's important in the context of recognizing this issue of balance. Because we want to be able to recognize when we're leaning one way or the other, or pitching forward or pitching back. We want to know when our energy is on the decline, when it's on the upswing, and when it's moving in or out of a range of comfort. And mindfulness provides that awareness. in the side of things which is involved with energizing us and empowering the work we do, we have a progression that begins with the quality of effort, which is it's got an aspect of arousing energy and an aspect of sustaining energy. And the arousing is a grosser effort that involves getting ourselves revved up. And then once we're revved, the amount of energy necessary to keep us operating at a level is much less. So first we push ourselves to get aroused, and then we recognize that's been achieved, and then we shift our energy to a lower level and just sustain it, which gives us energy that's not being expended in effort that can be used for other things. So we begin with some effort, and then we apply that effort to the task of investigating our experience. And that investigation has a quality of presence and awareness, which is geared toward having us see things clearly, recognizing the impermanence of things, as the Buddha pointed out. Impermanence and the stress that arises from that impermanence. And then the third factor that's energizing is joy and rapture. And those occur as we achieve clear seeing and have a sense of accomplishment in that, as we experience misperceptions being dropped, as we experience the arising of wisdom, and as we recognize the presence of freedom. So these are the progression of three energizing factors. Effort, which is the energy we put into it. Investigation, which is how we can use that energy to see what's present. And then the joy and rapture that arises as the benefits of that clear seeing are obtained. So those are the arousing factors. On the other side, we have stabilizing and calming factors. And those are concentration, which we cultivate in our sitting practice. Concentration being the focusing of awareness on an object or process so that we can actually see it. It's like focusing the lens of a microscope. Tranquility, which is awareness that's calm and steady. So in terms of seeing, that would be equivalent to holding the camera or the microscope and the slide steady so that you're not only in focus, but you're held, you're aware of what's going on with a single object. And then the third factor is equanimity, which is a quality of acceptance that we bring to whatever mindfully, whatever our mindfulness reveals. So it's a quality that's just willing to see whatever is there to be seen, unmovable and vast and expansive. You know, it's just broad and accepting of what's there. So those three stabilizing or calming factors are concentration, tranquility, focus, and stability, and equanimity that allows us to come to terms with whatever is being revealed. So those are some energetic qualities that we're going to be working with this weekend. So we will be entering into a deepening effort to achieve concentration and insight in our practice. And we'll be using those factors of concentration, tranquility, equanimity, investigation, or effort, investigation, and hopefully there will be some joy arising. So I think that's enough head stuff for now. So let's have a sitting, and And then Bridget will guide us in some closing activities.